I think I'm growing into someone you could trust. That's the Wonder Years. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. And yeah, my voice is barely hanging on right now. So looking forward to the next 2 hours. Yeah, that line is about Bowden Francis, who, yeah, growing into someone the Jays could potentially trust here. He goes 7 innings of shutout ball again yesterday for a 3rd consecutive start. He does not allow a base runner the first time through the order. He was incredibly pitch efficient, only took 70 pitches to get through 7 innings. He was headed to Maddux territory. The Jays did take him out after 7 innings and 70 pitches, coming off that 117 pitch no-hit attempt on Saturday against the Angels. He is pitching on normal rest here. He admitted to being a little fatigued and feeling, you know, a little less than his most electric warming up for this one. But man, if that is now what Bowden Francis looks like, not at his absolute best when he says he has to fight through it, man, what a story this has been from an aside piece in June of, yeah, Bowden Francis is toying with a splitter now while he was down in AAA, to, oh, his splitter has made his fastball borderline impossible to square up. And now he is doing things like posting the lowest whip in any 4-start span in the modern Major League Baseball era with a minimum of 20 innings, which reasonable for 4 starts. So yeah, the lowest number of base runners over a 4-start span in the modern MLB era, or doing things like being one of 5 players to have 4 consecutive starts of a 78 game score or higher. As I explained yesterday, Baseball Reference uses game score, scores every start on a 0 to 100 scale, where 50 is the league average, etc. 78 plus 4 in a row. I said heading into this one that he had done it 3 times in a row, and the last Blue Jay to do that was Roy Halladay. So you're already in great company. He's now one of 5 to ever do that 4 games in a row in Major League history. And the names that are on there with Bowden Francis are Clayton Kershaw, Johan Santana, Pedro Martinez, and Randy Johnson. I don't care how small the sample. I don't care what quality of competition caveat. I don't care what you want to throw at it. Being in a group like that is incredibly cool no matter what. The results have been great. It's looked pretty good for the most part. You could go back and you could nitpick from, you know, one of the Orioles starts or how we didn't get off to a great start in those games. You could go back and nitpick the first Angels outing. Hey, he got away with a lot of stuff over the plate, etc. But we're now looking at a larger sample here where Bowden Francis is probably going to win American League Pitcher of the Month for the month of August. 34 and a third innings, only 4 earned runs. That's a 105 ERA. I mentioned the 0.41 whip. Only 4 walks and 10 hits over 34 and a third innings with 39K. He's been worth more than 1 win above replacement in just this month alone. It's awesome. It's a lot of fun. It helped the Jays win a 2-0 game. A 2-0 game yesterday against the Red Sox. Take 3 of 5 in that series there. We also got to see Rich Hill, which is fun. Let's stay on the Bowden Francis topic, though. Let's tag in Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic, see how she's feeling, hopefully sounding better than I am. Caitlin, how we doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. You know, wish I could say I was feeling as good as Bowden Francis lately, but we play the hand we're dealt. How are you feeling, Bowden Francis-wise?
Yeah, I mean, your introduction, like, laid it out in terms of just all the, you know, amazing stats that he's been accumulating over the last handful of starts for him. And, yeah, you're right. Like, I mean, I think that, you know, I remember back in spring training, and a lot of people were talking about Bowden Francis around the organization. I remember Chris Bassett was raving about him. You know, some of the coaching staff were really impressed with what they saw. And then, yeah, he got off to a pretty slow start. You know, maybe just didn't look like he was fitting in that role in the rotation. It was sort of a disappointing start for him. And credit to him to continue to work, like you said, developing that splitter that is now a key pitch for him. And it's just a great story, I think, a great story of being able to, you know, not kind of get overwhelmed by that bad start, kind of just be able to continue to work. And he kind of handled everything that was dealt, you know, moving to the bullpen, going on the IL, going back down to the minors. And there's no guarantee in Major League Baseball that you're going to get a second chance, but you know, one of the silver linings, I guess, of this Blue Jays season kind of gone wrong is the fact that, yes, they moved on from some starters, traded Yusei Kikuchi away. That opened up an opportunity for Bowden Francis to get back into the rotation, you know, something that might not have happened had the Blue Jays been, you know, going for a playoff spot. So he's made the most of that second opportunity, obviously basically kind of rewriting his season. I think most people are going to kind of forget about the start that he had or not think too deeply about it because of the way that he's ending the season. So yes, it's impressive. Really makes you think, you know, heading into the off season, you know, maybe the Blue Jays don't have to get two starters, right? Maybe they really just need one starter. And then between, you know, Jake Bloss, Bowden Francis and Yuriel Rodriguez, maybe they do have enough depth there to fill out that fifth starter and then some guys, some extra guys that can fill in for them. So yeah, it's a great story for the Blue Jays. It's a great story for Bowden Francis, and it's been fun to watch, I think, especially that's the other thing. It's, you know, not a lot of great games to watch down the stretch for the Blue Jays, but I think now every time Bowden Francis pitches, you never know if you're going to be watching a no-hitter or something.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly you are the first time through the order. That seems to be a lock now. And you mentioned that, you know, this kind of makes you forget about the tough start to the season. Not only that, the numbers have been so extreme that his ERA on the year is down to 3.66. Like, even including the rough start, his numbers just look good overall, and that's over almost 80 innings. You know, I think probably what's most fascinating is how he's just like ditched walking guys entirely. You know, the strikeout numbers aren't crazy. He's had a couple of good strikeout outings, but he just, so yeah, I'm not gonna walk anyone ever. Kaitlin, I know you weren't in Boston for this one, but you were there on Saturday when he nearly threw a no-hitter here in Toronto. What was his mentality coming out of that one? What have you been able to pick up from talking to him during this? Like, I think we all checked the box of like, okay, we understand Bowden's like an interesting cat and an interesting story coming into spring training or whatever. And then during the struggle, he was like pretty open about what wasn't working. But now that the success has come, what have you been able to pick up from him or where his mentality's at?
Yeah, I mean, it seems that he's benefited from being in the starting rotation once again. I think that that's been one of the things that stood out that people have said about him is that he seems to work well in that typical starter's routine. I think having time between starts to really kind of figure out how to approach a team, and I think that he just finds some stability and comfort in that role. I think he's also been able to spend more time with Chris Bassett and Kevin Gausman, and they've really kind of taken him under their wing, helped guide him. I think there's been a lot of stories about, you know, Bassett and Gausman too, kind of discussing the splitter. And I think Gausman was joking the other day that like now he's not the guy that has to answer all the questions about the splitter anymore. People are asking Bowden Francis about the splitter now. So I think he's just been benefiting from just being around the team more, being in that starting rotation, and learning from other guys with the team. And you never know, like maybe there is some benefit to pitching in a little bit lower pressure, right? Again, the Blue Jays aren't necessarily in the playoff chase anymore, and so I think that that's probably been something. Now obviously you want a guy to be able to pitch under pressure because the Blue Jays want to compete next year, but maybe it's just helped to settle in a little bit and make those starts when you know, it doesn't feel like you have to live and die with every single pitch. And yeah, I know, again, like it's just been, you know, he is an interesting guy. He's a guy that is very zen, I suppose. I mean, you know, he does his meditations, he does all that kind of stuff, was doing that during, I think, the no-hit bid, and guys were obviously leaving him alone. And, you know, after he lost the no-hitter, he seemed to handle it really well. I think that he was just appreciative of having the opportunity to go for it. Obviously, John Schneider and Pete Walker kind of said, like, this is your game. You go until you give up a hit. And I think he was just, you know, happy for the moment, obviously slightly disappointed. But he kind of tried to cling on to the positives as opposed to thinking of the negatives, which was just that one pitch that he gave up.
Yeah. And it's a good, good lesson for all of us. And maybe you're not as zen as Bowden Francis, but he told Ben Nicholson Smith after the game, the numbers will take care of themselves. If you're thinking about the right stuff and treating people the right way, I think the universe has a way of unraveling things. I've just got to keep level headed. Maybe something for all of us in there, Kaitlin. You mentioned the his camaraderie there with Bassett and Gausman as well. How much do you think this has meant to, you know, it's hard to say how much it means big picture, because again, we could talk about that, you know, what does it look like for the 2025 rotation, et cetera. But it really does seem from afar that it has meant a lot to the guys in that dugout to, you know, see Bowden have this success. Like, it's, you know, obviously all 26 guys are rooting for each other, but this seems like a particularly pronounced example of that.
Yeah, I think because, again, like, I remember in spring training, I think there were a lot of expectations and optimism around Bowden Francis, and some of the fellow starters were talking about him, saying that he's a guy that could step into rotation and be a reliable pitcher for us, and he's a guy that could lead the way for us. Like, those were some things that, you know, Chris Bassett was saying, and it didn't get off to that start at the beginning of the year, and maybe there's some disappointment, you know, not necessarily, you know, it's no one's fault. It's just, you know, it hasn't gone the way that everybody thought it would. And so I guess there's some satisfaction and just some, you know, happiness over the fact that Bowden has been able to bounce back, doesn't let that slow start define his season, and has made, you know, great strides in the time since then to get to be that guy who can be a part of the rotation, potentially can lead the way. So I think that, yeah, I think, you know, overall, when we're talking about the Blue Jays season, basically post-trade deadline, it's still a team and they're still going out there and they're trying to win. But I think in some ways the season becomes a little bit more individualized. And I just mean that by, you know, guys, once you're not kind of pulling in the same goal for trying to make the playoffs, I think then you're turning to, okay, let's see how Spencer Horwitz handles more playing time. Let's see how Will Wagner handles his first taste of the major league. Let's see how Addison Barger responds to, again, more playing time and his third go at the major leagues. And so then you're starting to kind of pay attention to individual storylines. And I think that that is then what this team and teammates kind of root for. And they're happy to see some of the young position players getting more comfortable facing major league pitching. And then with Bowden Francis, you're excited to see him getting more comfortable in that starting rotation, getting on a roll, facing teams, you know, two times in a short span and being able to handle that challenge. So I think that part of it is just that now that the Blue Jays are no longer sort of fighting for a playoff spot, what the team and the guys on the team have to root for is some of those individual storylines and seeing guys individually succeed.
Yeah, and look, it being about individual stuff isn't a negative. It's a realistic thing. You don't have the playoff goal to push for. And, I mean, these guys are all in competitions already, right? Like, Spencer Horwitz, what do you look like with regular playing time, is part of the early 2025 competition. Will Wagner as well. Bowden Francis and Yariel Rodriguez. I'm sure they want each other to succeed, and it'd be great if both of them were awesome, but they're also probably competing against each other for a 2025 role early on here. Caitlin, with the Jays having played a little bit better of late, has anything happened in the bullpen that is, you know, changed how you're thinking about 2025? You know, I look at Chad Green, he's 16-16 in save opportunities, 161 ERA, which is like nobody's going to maintain a 161 ERA and unless you're the very, very top end of the closer tier. But even his underlying metrics have started to, you know, come down and line up a little bit more with what the actual results have been. Do you think, I guess the salary maybe dictates this anyways, but Chad Green pretty solidified himself as an eighth inning guy for next year?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think that while Jordan Romano is going to be able to come back, whether it's this year or next year, I don't know yet, but he's going to come back and he's going to have the opportunity to retain his closer role. But I think having somebody else in the bullpen who has been a guy that has been able to handle the ninth inning has more or less been a proven starter. Obviously, Chad Green's had a long career, a long time in with the Yankees in those high leverage situations, and he's proven himself. So it's not like he had to come here and prove himself as a guy that you could rely on, but certainly he still looks like the guy that can be relied upon after that Tommy John surgery a couple years ago. And so, yeah, I mean, the Blue Jays bullpen overall still needs a lot of work this offseason. Beyond Chad Green, I think Yenesis Cabrera is a guy that you can count on. Maybe a few guys. I think Brendan Little is shown something. I think that he's had his moments where he's really looked good. I think he definitely has put himself in the conversation for next year's bullpen. And then, of course, Jordan Romano. Eric Swanson probably still needs to show a little bit more with the rest of the season. Obviously, very tough start to the season, both on and off the field. And, you know, he's had his moments since he's come back. And I think that with the month or so remaining, probably needs to show a little bit more of the guy that he used to be. And then maybe you can count upon him. But yeah, I mean, I think the bullpen still, to me, is like one of the areas that has some of the biggest question marks, I think, moving forward. And just in terms of like, I do think you need to bring in a lot of new guys. I don't know that anyone's completely standing out in the minor leagues. Maybe a guy here and there, Hagen Danner's maybe one guy that I think could be part of the conversation next year. But yeah, Chad Green, you know, at least you have him. You have some guys that you can rely upon to handle some of those leverage roles. But I think ultimately it's going to take a lot of work to rebuild the bullpen to getting to close to something that is major league average next year.
Yeah, like I'm stretching here and I'm looking. I'm like, okay, well, Nance, Swanson, Yarbrough, Little, and Cabrera all have ERAs under 4 over the last 30 days. Like, that is not – I'm reaching here. That's a little bit too much of a reach there. Okay, you mentioned Jordan Romano. This question applies to Bo Bichette as well. We obviously don't have an update on those guys. Bo Bichette doing agility drills on the field yesterday. They're not rushing, but said to be making good progress. We think Jordan Romano – was going to be making a beginning a throwing progression sometime this week. Where do you see the value? Where do the Blue Jays see the value in getting those guys a couple reps down the stretch here, even just to get their feet wet ahead of 2025?
Yeah, I think that's it. It's just about, I guess, sending them into the offseason with a little bit more certainty of, you know, their health and their status. I think that, you know, you're not going to be able to change your season with a handful of outings or a handful of starts to end the year. I think both Jordan Romano and Bo Bichette are going to look back upon this season and think it was disappointing, not just for their performance, but also their health, right? They missed a lot of time. Clearly, Jordan's dealing with the elbow thing for probably the entire season, just given that this is an injury that dates back to spring training. Bo Bichette just did not look like himself this year. You wonder how much the leg had to do with that. Just kind of couldn't get out of the rut that he started the season in. And so, you know, a couple starts and a couple outings aren't going to change the narrative of that season. But I do think that you can at least get on the field, at least feel healthy, at least feel like, okay, I'm going into next season feeling good. I'm going into the off season feeling good. I've at least answered the question that I'm healthy and can, you know, play again. Obviously, that's, you know, inevitable that they're going to play again. But still, I just think it gives the team and the player a little bit more certainty going into next year, going into the off season, and just kind of knowing at least the injury is behind them and they can kind of just prepare to obviously have a bounce back year next year.
Yeah. And those would be, you know, later in September moves. They are not joining the roster on Sunday when rosters expand. We'll get two new players up here, Caitlin, or not up here, in Minnesota. We'll see them Tuesday when the Phillies are here. Who are your eyes on? I know you wrote about this for The Athletic yesterday, so we're just going to kind of, you know, recontextualize that article. But on the pitching side, did Jake Bloss getting shelled the other day, do you think that shifted the plan or the timeline on Bloss at all, perhaps?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I haven't been able to talk to anyone like with the Blue Jays organization because I'm not around the team right now. And just in terms of like, yeah, does that one outing give them pause to bring him up? Does it make them think that maybe he is fatigued? It's obviously been a long season for him just in terms of, you know, all the milestones, I guess, that he's achieved. He came up, I think, what, 3 levels all the way to the major leagues this year with Houston, you know, making his debut earlier in the season. And so the Blue Jays were fairly cautious with him once they acquired him. Obviously, he's the one guy in that Kikuchi deal who hasn't been called up yet or hasn't been with the major league team yet. And the Blue Jays, it seems like they've done that kind of purposefully in that, you know, they had the opportunity to give him a breather. So they did that. They, you know, sent him to Florida initially, just got him getting some baseline measurements on him and, you know, what he is like as a starter, what his pitches look like, all that kind of stuff. So you do that, and then you send him to Buffalo. He's made four starts. The three previous to the one this week went really well. He didn't allow a run. And then obviously he got shelled, as you say, earlier this week. I think it was giving up, what, 8 runs on 9 hits or something like that. So I think that maybe gives them some pause, but I do think it's probably, you know, there's not a lot of guys, other guys that are necessarily knocking on the door in terms of, you know, roster expansion. I think if your goal is to continue to evaluate some of the new players, I think it is worth giving Blas a look in the major leagues just to see, you know, what he can do. Maybe the fact that they're moving to a six-man rotation, or at least with Blas, they could move to a six-man rotation, and then at least you're still building in that extra rest for them. Maybe that makes them think it's worth a shot, because you're not necessarily making him pitch on regular rest. You're giving him the extra rest. So you hope that if there is some fatigue factoring in, you build in some of that protection with the six-man rotation. You know, so I still think there's probably a good chance that we'll see him. It just kind of makes sense with the what the motivation has been for the Blue Jays. They've obviously been calling up a lot of the other new guys to give them a chance to see what they can do and give them a chance to play with the major league club. So I would think that it would still be a kind of a priority. That said, you know, maybe there is some pause or some extra consideration given how the last outing went for him.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. And also, you know, the Jays have said, yeah, they want to get guys extra rest where they can. They have 5 off days in September. So they're in a stretch. They're about to finish up this stretch of a really condensed schedule. But there are only 2 instances in September where their pitchers would even be pitching on normal rest because of how the off days structure. You could get away with just using a 6th starter twice the rest of the way, really. So maybe that, you know, Blas could do a little up and down, and in between that they can get another bullpen arm. You know, you mentioned in your piece Paolo Espino, who would be a length option, but if they want to evaluate guys, Espino is almost 38 years old. I think we know who he is. Brandon Eichert, Jose Quas, Jerry Rodriguez, Luis Frias, Easton Lucas, Hagen Danner. Those are the other pitchers at AAA who are on the 40-man and wouldn't require a roster move to be added. Caitlin, on the other side, Jonathan Class A seemed like the obvious one to be added to the roster after the trade deadline. I thought maybe even there was a chance he would take the Stuart Burrow role before September 1st. He's really struggled at AAA since joining the Bisons. Any potential there, do you think, for it to be a kind of overdue Nathan Lucas nod instead of Jonathan Class A, at least at the beginning of the month?
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I think that, you know, the Blue Jays are an organization that's really likes Nathan Lucas, and he's been that very dependable, reliable depth guy for them, right? Remember last year, he was up and down with the club a ton of time, has always just kind of put his head down and done his job. And I think you think back to spring training, and he was just the odd man out, right? He had a really good spring training, and just, you know, they couldn't fit him on the roster. It just wasn't a need for them with what they were going for. And then he went down to AAA again and had a really good season to start, got injured, had a thumb injury, needed surgery, so missed a couple months there, but has come back and has hit really well. And so, you know, if you're the Blue Jays and you're trying to kind of do right by a guy that has always been, you know, good for your organization, at least since he joined it a couple of years ago, you know, maybe they do give him a nod. I think Class A, again, if we're thinking about the team wanting to give some looks to the new guys, you know, then maybe you think, well, maybe they prioritize him. He has some speed. Maybe you see what he can do on the base path for you. He's not, or I should say the Blue Jays aren't a base stealing team. I know they were kind of running a little bit on Danny Jansen there, probably have some intel on him. But I think that, yeah, also Alan Roden's another guy that has been really, really good lately. He's not on the 40-man, though, so I think that that's a bit of an obstacle for him. I don't think he needs to be added to the 40-man for a couple years. So do the Blue Jays want to use a roster spot on him when they don't have to yet? There might be a roster crunch, so that probably is a bit of an obstacle for him. So I do think it could be down to Lucas or Class A, and it just depends on, you know, what the Blue Jays think they need to see. Do they think they want Class A to spend more time in AAA, maybe get into a rhythm? Meanwhile, they kind of reward Nathan Lucas with a couple of weeks in the major leagues. Maybe they do that. The flip side is maybe they just want to see Class A and what he can do at the major league level for them.
Yeah, and it's an interesting one with Roden, because, you know, he's the guy I'd be most interested to see. But like you said, not only does he not have a 40-man spot, he's not Rule 5 eligible until after next season. So if you add him now, you burn an option year next year. Like, to make that move, you'd have to be pretty certain he's in the mix for the roster at some point next year. Otherwise, it's probably not worthwhile. Last one for you before I let you go, Caitlin. This is about September roster shuffling as well, but in the other direction. Davis Schneider has one hit over the last like 3.5 weeks. His numbers for the season are down to a 196 batting average, 291 OBP. That works out to an 82 WRC plus, so well below league average. Do you think it would benefit him at all to get a couple weeks in AAA before this season wraps up? Like there's still 3.5 weeks left in the AAA season. Get some regular reps, try to find some better footing under him.
Yeah, I think there's a few ways to think about it. I mean, I think that, you know, if the season had been going differently, obviously if the Blue Jays were making a playoff push, they would have made a different decision on Davis Schneider by now, assuming that he was still struggling. I think that, you know, one of the things that you send a guy down to the major leagues or down to the minor leagues for is, you know, are they struggling with confidence? Do they need a boost? I think the vibe around Davis is that he's been the same guy. He's actually been handling the struggles well, in the sense that I don't think he's necessarily like down on himself. I think he's frustrated. I think he's, you know, upset or angry that he's not getting the results, that he knows he can be better. But I don't know that it's necessarily affecting his confidence. Now, that was a couple of weeks ago where I've talked to people about him. So I don't know, maybe in the time since then, it's changed a little bit. The other factor you have to consider is, you know, is it better to keep him in the major league environment where he can continue to work with the coaches that he has obviously worked with all year? Matt Haig is a guy that he dates back a couple years with, worked with him in AAA, obviously been working with him this year. Is it better to keep him in that environment where he can continue the work that he's doing? Or, you know, is it better to get him a little bit extra playing time in AAA? So I don't know. I think you don't want to have the option do more harm than good. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, I was thinking, well, if they want to expand the roster and bring up somebody, and then they also got to make a move to get Bo, you know, maybe that's when it could happen. But then, you know, saying that, there's only the AAA season will end sooner than the major league season. So I don't know how much time you would be able to get Davis Schneider. So I do think that's something the team is probably thinking about. I think you can make the case either way. I think it's just a matter of what they think is best for him. Do they think it would be good for him to go down in a lower pressure environment? I don't know that they thought that a couple weeks ago, but maybe it's changed since he still isn't getting those results.
Yeah, it's a tough one, and obviously a very easy guy to root for, and someone who's done enough work over the years that you expect he'll figure it out eventually. But yeah, it's been a tough couple weeks. Caitlin, thank you so much for taking the time out. I will see you at the park next week.
Yep, sounds good. Thank you.
Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic. Make sure you're checking out all the great work there. She went a little deeper on some of those September call-up options over at The Athletic yesterday. I had a really great two-part mailbag as well last week that answered a lot of questions we get in the text line here that she gets in the comment section there all the time. So lots of good stuff there. Lots of good stuff to come in the show. We're going to talk to Brian Hawkinsmith of ESPN, David Lorela of Fangraphs, Anthony Castrovince of MLB.com, and Brendan Warren of Access Twins. Whip around baseball a little bit, get you set up for the Jays Twin Series that starts tonight at 8:10. Kevin Gausman against Pablo Lopez. Before we take a break here and talk to Ryan, though, if you haven't heard and seen the news, or even if you have, Johnny Gaudreau of the Columbus Blue Jackets and his brother Matthew, who is also a pro hockey player, tragically passed away last night. It is reported that a drunk driver struck them and killed them. He's been charged with that. So obviously our condolences go out to the Gaudreau family, who were set to celebrate a wedding in the family this week, to the entire hockey world and hockey community. We send our condolences and best wishes. And man, there's just no excuse for driving drunk ever, but especially in an era where we have things like Uber and Lyft and things like that, just heading into the long weekend here, keep that front of mind as well. Just absolutely no excuse for something like that, and a very, very sad day in the hockey world. So our condolences and thoughts with the Gaudreau family and the hockey community. We'll take a break here. When we come back, we'll talk to Ryan Hawkinsmith about a little Paul Skeens stuff. We'll whip around as well, and then we'll get back into Bowden Francis. We'll get back into this Twins series in the second hour as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays win 2-0 last night. Bowden Francis with another gem. Vlad comes up with an RBI double off the wall. Ernie Clement has an RBI double a little later. Brian Servin and Addison Barger both have ground rule doubles down the right field line. And yeah, speaking of the weird Fenway dimensions, I hope Joey Loperfido's okay. He backed up into that wall to make a catch to help out Bowden Francis in the sixth or seventh inning and banged his head pretty bad. Came out of that game. He was undergoing tests last night. We'll surely get an update before the game today. Update from around baseball. We're going to talk a lot of AL Central in the second hour of the show. Vinny Pascantino broke his hand and he's off to the IL for like 6 to 8 weeks. So the red hot Royals take a hit there. In the NL Central, Paul Skeens remains the hottest and most fun name in baseball and must-watch guy. A tremendous, tremendous piece at ESPN this week by Ryan Hawkinsmith on Paul Skeens and his time at Air Force and how that's kind of informed who he's become as a pitcher. Ryan Hawkinsmith joins us now. Ryan, good morning. Thank you for doing this.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Okay, so before we get into the Skeens stuff, congratulations. You'll be in the 2024 collection of the year's best sports writing. I guess, first of all, do you know which of your stories is in there? Because they're like so secretive about like which we know the authors. We don't know the stories. You know, though, right?
I do know. Do you want me to tell you?
I mean, if you can, I don't want you to get like removed from the book for sharing the secret.
Well, if they kick, it's too late. I think they printed it, so I'm in. No, I did a story about like I went to a minor league baseball game and they had like some sort of $50,000 giveaway if somebody made a, I forget what the crazy contest was, but I was like, where did these come from? How did they become such a part of sports? And so I went back and looked at the first big contest win. And there was a guy in 1993 at a Bulls game who hit an 80-foot shot to win $1 million. And the Bulls went crazy. Michael, it's the happiest I've ever seen Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen. Like they were so happy for this guy and they celebrated. And they had a press conference for this guy and everything. And then the insurance company tried to not give him the money because he had walked on at a junior college and played. Aww. Yeah. So they said, oh, no. Fine print. You played organized basketball. I think he was 3 of 12 in one, you know, 5 games or something. But Michael Jordan fought for him to get the $1 million. And then so I wrote about sports contests, what that guy did with the $1 million. And it ended up being a cool story. It answers the questions if you're like, wow, $1 million. Why would insurance, how do they pay that money? Do they pay that money? So it dealt with sports contests, but it also had a personal story behind it, too.
Yeah, it sounds like a great beat. I didn't catch that one, but I do remember, I do remember the shot that you're talking about and the Jordan Pippen reactions. This is not related to your story, but you also have roots, you know, you've been at ESPN in a couple different roles, but you had a big hand in ESPNW as well. And on the cover of this year's 2024 Best Sports Writing, Caitlin Clark is on the cover. It seems like based on the authors that are listed as in the book, there's a lot more women's sports coverage in there now than there maybe was when these anthologies started coming out. How much does that mean to you, given, you know, your own roots in the ESPNW coverage?
It means a lot. It is a really fun time, and it's been cool to watch the rise of women's sports. And, you know, the editor of the book is Jane McManus, who I work with at ESPNW, and she did some of the most important work you're ever going to read about, you know, we worked together when the Ray Rice thing happened, and there's been a, you know, there began a new chapter of the way that journalists cover domestic violence, and so I'm very proud, and we cover it differently and better, I think, than ever, and Jane did some great work back then. And, you know, it was cool to kind of reunite when she called me to tell me that I was in the book. I was like, yeah, you owe me. No, I just kidding. I didn't say that. But, you know, it was just a cool reuniting. And yeah, it is a very cool moment. It's so fun to see these games blowing up. And when I was at W, you just realized it was just awesome to be immersed in women's sports and realize how cool. And, you know, a lot of them are growing. So it's cool when stuff's growing. It's cool to be along for the ride. And so I was proud to see that, you know, in the book.
Yeah, it's cool to see and you know, only going to continue to ride. Obviously, WNBA side is expanding. We're getting a team here pretty soon. So I'll have to trade in all my New York Liberty gear. Yeah. And okay. So again, it's 2024 year's best sports writing. You could pre-order it now. There's an exclusive book launch on the Seton Hall University YouTube on September 10th. So people can check that out if they want a little bit more detail. Our pal Alex Coffey, also in the book. I think she'll be on the show next week to talk Phillies with us. So lots awesome. Of good stuff in there. Let's pivot to baseball. Ryan, let's talk about this Paul Skeens story. So it's a tremendous piece. We're not going to be able to get into all of it because it's like a 25-minute read. It's tremendous. What made you want to dig in on this story initially? Like what was the kind of pitch or idea formation process of, hey, let's go deep on Paul Skeens' time at Air Force during the pandemic and how it kind of made Paul Skeens?
Well, he's an awesome athlete, an A-list guy. And so I like to, like, is there a story there with LeBron or, you know, biggest names in sports? You want to be talking about them. And when I read about Paul Skeens, a couple of things jumped out at me. One is he just turned 22. Like, he's so young. And then the second thing that really got me interested was when I read just some of the basic profiles of him, you realize this guy just turned 22 and he has barely pitched. And that's what he looks like out there. He has barely pitched. His entire senior year was wiped out of high school because of COVID. So he pitched basically zero innings, right? And then he goes to Air Force as a catcher. And so most of his teenage years were not spent on the mound. It was as a catcher. And then he goes to Air Force. And his first year at Air Force, I've never heard of this combination. He's the catcher and he's the closer. So the first eight innings of a game, I mean, most people had never seen anything like this, right? And there's an anecdote in the story about the LSU fans when Air Force played LSU, he caught for eight innings and then he took the gear off and ran out to do a couple of pitches in the bullpen area. And the crowd was like, oh, they're out of pitchers. I mean, who has to use their catcher as the pitcher? It's crazy. And so he was the closer that year. And I don't know the number off the top of my head, but he threw like 25 innings or something, you know? So when you think about this guy's arm, he has, you know, arm injuries are a key part of every, like almost every pitcher in baseball. There's the story of their life, you know. He has like nothing on his arm, you know, and he's a big, tall guy with a good, slow, sort of methodical motion who has barely pitched. And so the thing that drew me in was just like, what a prodigy this guy is. Like, he really is a phenom. I don't think that we're anywhere close to like how good he can be. And that is a scary proposition.
It is scary. And you mentioned, you know, there are fewer miles on his arm. So maybe he stays healthier longer but also like maybe he figures out how to pitch even better and even better because he just doesn't have as many reps. And you're right. The 26 and two thirds innings in 2021 as a freshman with a 270 ERA. And oh, by the way, he hit over 400 and hit 11 home runs in 48 games as a catcher. Crazy.
Unbelievable.
So the number one thing, so I knew that he was a catcher. I didn't realize he was like this good a catcher where the trainers he worked with are like, oh yeah, he could step in and be a top pitch framer and receiver right now. You have a great anecdote from an umpire who's like, I'm going to lose my job because this kid is too good. The hands are too fast. Why do you think he's not a two-way player?
Well, they kicked it around, but, you know, one of the things that's really interesting about the way that we absorb young pitchers is when you can hit 100 miles per hour, it takes, so the conversation is just like, okay, this guy needs to be pitching. And so he got directed that way. He fought at Air Force for the whole year. He caught a lot at Air Force in his second year there. But man, it just the way that we talk about pitchers who can throw 100 miles per hour, it just, you know, it's like being like, oh, I'm a really good quarterback, but I also like playing safety. It's like, no. It's not how this works. You are a phenom level pitcher. And so there just was no chance. By the time he transferred to LSU as a junior, there was so much buzz about him as a starter that it's just number one starter who can throw 100 miles per hour. It's just like, forget everything else. And that's kind of what happened to him.
So when it comes to him going to LSU after 2 years at Air Force, the way the context reads and the way I understand it from at the time is he probably could have gone to a bigger school right away. Like obviously his senior year gets wiped out, but even without that, he probably could have gone to an LSU, a UCLA or something like that. What does it tell you about Skeens, the person and how he's gotten here that he wanted to honor that commitment to Air Force, not just like academically and commitment wise, but he really wanted, it really comes through in your story, how much he wanted to do the rigor of the Air Force and like that schedule and attention to detail and things like that. Like it really seems like that was an important couple of years for him.
He wanted to serve, you know, he had a lot of relatives who served in the military and he's, you know, I write about it, and I tried to be honest about it. He's a rules guy. He likes, like, you know, at 5 a.m., a loud song plays and everybody has to wake up. He's that kind of guy. He had a gig as a sophomore where he was policing guys' facial hair, what their rooms looked like. This was a role that the Air Force had. And when you think about how annoying those people were, you know, like everybody who has like in the United States, we call it RAs, you know, resident assistants. There's a person on every floor of a college dorm.
I was one.
You were?
Yeah.
Okay. So did you like, was it a part of you that you liked to kind of be a rules person?
No, it was free room and board and a free meal plan when I was a broke student. I actually got in trouble at one point because I didn't discipline anyone like the entire year.
So you know exactly how hard it would have been to like walk up to your buddy three doors down. And I have an anecdote in there about he went up to basketball. He was the captain of the basketball team and said, your room's a mess. And he failed the guy. He gave him a 30 out of 100. And said, this is an atrocity. And the basketball player was like, dude, I'm a senior. Come on, cut me some slack. And he was like, clean your room. That's the kind of guy he is. And I'll tell you what, I talked to probably 15 people for this story. And a lot of them were like, this is the kind of guy who's not just a game changer as a baseball player. He's going to change the entire Pirates mentality. Like, you're going to have to deal with Paul Skeens. And he's only 22. You can imagine if he keeps getting better. Gets a big contract, and he's going to be kind of like the RA of the Pirates, and you're going to have to deal with him. And I think that bodes well. I think you want like that kind of guy in your clubhouse, and he is that guy.
Yeah. And like, I don't, you know, I'm a little too young to remember all of the anecdotes, but that level of, not that level of like, hey man, clean your locker stall or trim your facial hair. But like, everyone always tells stories about Roy Halladay being this incredible lead by example guy, right? Like if you are on Roy Halladay's team, you know that this is the level of preparation and focus and excellence that is expected of everyone. You know, that's the kind of thing. Now, having said all that, while Paul Skeens is a rule follower and things like that, there's also some fire in there, right? Like there's this great anecdote you tell in the story of him getting shown up on a home run and just like standing in front of the plate. And Paul Skeens is not a small dude. So just like blocking the plate. So the guy had to just kind of like gingerly put his foot between his legs to touch home plate. And I thought, you know, the line that comes up a couple times in your story that's so great is, yeah, he's like Mozart, Metallica. You know, how cool is that? And you know, how central to that is that to Paul Skeens, the pitcher, like once the game actually starts, that ability to go, hey, I'm this guy, I'm straight and narrow, but there is like a real fire here.
There is an edge to him. Like he wants to win bad. And that's why I think like with the Pirates going forward, like if he shows up at 3 hours before the game and most players show up 2 hours before the game, within a couple of weeks, people are going to be showing up 3 hours before the game. That's kind of the way he does things. And that anecdote in the story was one of his friends gave up just a no question home run where he didn't even turn around off the mound to look at it. And what he was looking at, he was waiting for the ball to be thrown back to him, was Skeens was really mad behind the plate because this guy was like showboating down the first baseline. And it was like this 60 second home run thing. And Skeens stood at the plate and yelled, run, start running. And he was really mad, and he just stood on the plate, and the umpire saw as this guy was rounding third base, like, oh, there's about to be a fist fight at home plate. And so the ump was like, back up, back up, back up. And Skeens would just inch 1 millimeter off the plate, and he ended up standing over the plate as this guy got around the bases. And he's a very fiery guy. And I don't think, you know, they had a 10-game losing streak recently. I think it was 10 games with the Pirates where they fell out of contention really for a wild card spot. I just don't think you're going to want to be around. Like, he's going to be a guy who's like, that's not good enough, guys. And, you know, I just imagine that the same way he stood over home plate and was feisty, that you're going to see that every day in the Pirates clubhouse.
Okay, last Skeens one for you before we pivot off. There is quite a National League Rookie of the Year debate to come here. I guess I should ask first, you don't have a BBWAA vote on National League Rookie of the Year, do you?
No, but I would have already submitted it for Skeens, and I would have been like, oh, shoot, I should probably thought that.
Yeah,
it's funny. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, because I know you're not allowed to talk about it if you have a vote, so I didn't want to put you in an awkward spot. But yeah, Skeens, Merrill, Wynn, I guess even like Fitzgerald and Imanaga, it's a pretty tight one. It's one of those ones where like, I would understand the case against Skeens because it's just 109 innings, et cetera. But it seems like one that if he doesn't win it, it's going to look weird after, right?
It is, because I do think this guy has a chance to be like a generational talent that like everybody would die to have as their. I mean, he has a chance to be like the best pitcher in baseball soon, like very, very soon. And so it could look weird, but it is a good rookie year, right? And the other night, I think he left the game. They were up 10-3, 10-2, something like that. And the Pirates blew it against the Cubs. It's possible this guy has like 10 wins. Like he's 10-3 or 10-4. And that doesn't look that impressive. You know, it doesn't. But the strikeouts, the WAR, the ERA are all going to be off the charts. I mean, he's just had an unbelievable year. And he did start the All-Star game. And so I think that's probably going to linger with people. It's going to be a very interesting race. I'm biased. I just wrote about Paul Skeen, so it's like I'm gonna vote for Paul Skeen. And who knows? Maybe Livy Dunn can get a good. His girlfriend's Livy Dunn, who's like one of those. When you talk about influencers, she's an influencer, capital I. Maybe she'll rally some votes for him.
Yeah, we'll see how that works out. Okay, let's pivot off the Skeens topic. I know you're like an MMA and combat sports guy as well. You wrote a terrific Mark Coleman piece about him surviving a fire. You did a. As a former wrestler, what I thought was a really good piece on cauliflower ear. What draws you to those kind of stories in the combat sports realm?
Oh, man, I love wrestling really was really, really hard sport and losing weight and everything. I wrestled in Pennsylvania and there's like a trait to these guys that is just such an important part of life. You know, the thing that drew me to Mark Coleman so much is that I write in the story. A lot of these guys, you do not want them managing your 401k. They are not those kinds of people, okay? But, man, they know how to plow through hard things. And if you – most of us human beings are going to have a hard thing in life where it doesn't – having a therapist is really nice, which I have a therapist. I'm a big therapy person. But, like, when you're dealing with some of this really, really hard stuff, you got to just do it one day at a time, 1 hour at a time, and you got to just plow through. And Mark Coleman – MMA fighters, wrestlers, they're really good at that. They know how to just like, I got to put in 2 hours of running right now and doing it. So I'm drawn to that level of athlete. And you see it in other walks of life, you know, where that trait of just no thought about it, just do it. And it's just like such a valuable trait. So I'm drawn to those athletes a lot. And I don't know, I'm a big dumb meathead kind of. So I like when fighting is, I don't really want to see a fight at a gas station, but man, you know, you lock two pros in a cage. I'm drawn to it. And there's definitely nights where I'm watching the UFC and I'm like, what have I done with my life? It's 12:30 at night. I paid $80, but I'm like, this is the best. I love it.
Yeah, I feel similarly. Like I have I created a UFC fantasy league format with some friends that we have a Discord and like, obviously you can't play it out there a ton, but we just made our own just to put a little extra spice on it or whatever. And I feel similarly. Sometimes I'm watching, I'm like, And then some of the like personalities outside of the cage get pretty dicey as well. But I don't know. I don't know if it's because I wrestled or love boxing too. I don't know. But there's something to it. Okay, last one before I let you go. I know you're a big baseball card guy. I know you've written about it. Back during the pandemic, and that was much more from an emotional and an attachment to baseball card side. Do you have like a favorite or holy grail baseball card though?
Oh man. Well, I grew up as a Dodgers fan, and I love Pedro Guerrero, which is a really old guy name to throw out there. But I have a couple Pedro Guerrero rookie cards, and they meant so much to me as a kid. And also, I'll give you a curveball one. Is you're too young. How old are you? You're a young guy.
I'm 38.
38. Okay, so you were little. But in 1989, there was an error card with a bad word on the knob of a baseball
bat. Billy Ripken.
Yes, and it starts with an F. it's a really bad word that I won't say here, but man, being 12 years old at that time, it was a bad word. Oh my God. This has a bad word on it. I love that card to this day, you know, and there's all these variations of it. And I don't know what it was. One of the things I wrote about baseball cards is like a lot of my cards aren't worth anything monetarily. Like if you wouldn't buy them off of me, but I wouldn't sell them to you. That's what they mean to me, you know? And almost every collector, even right now, I bet, when you buy cards with your mom or your dad, it's just a part of you. And that's what those, you know, I wrote about how, like, I called it my priceless, worthless baseball card collection because you're just not going to make any money off of it. But, like, it's like your high school yearbook or photos of you and your dad. It's like a snapshot. And so that Billy Ripken error card was like sort of naughty, like this thing, like, don't tell mom I got one, you know? And that I think the Billy Ripken error card might be like my favorite card ever.
Nice. And that was, I mean, it's a good year. So that was, I think, Fleer. And then there's the iconic Griffey Upper Deck rookie card that same year. So a good year for cards. Yeah. And the dad drop or the, like, they're worth it. Like, my dad, it lives in Newfoundland. He just has like boxes and boxes and boxes of hockey cards that you could just, when you go visit, you just sort through and just remember some guys. Ryan, thanks so much for doing this, man. Really appreciate it. Had a lot of fun.
Yeah, me too. Thank you for thanks for everything. You read a lot of my stuff. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great work, man. I enjoyed it. Ryan Hockensmith of ESPN. And again, you could check out more of his and everyone's stuff in the 2024 Best of Sports Writing, which is coming out soon. And they're doing a full reveal on September 10th on the Seton Hall University YouTube page. Speaking of things that are releing, our pal Oceanator dropped a new album today. I saw her. So I was in New York with Jeff Rosenstock and Pup earlier in the weekend, and Oceanator also came on stage and played and was taking some photographs and stuff. Anyway, she dropped a new album today. You should check it out if you're into that kind of music. Anyway, let's take a break. Let's get back to baseball. We'll talk to David Lorelei, Anthony Castrovince, and Brandon Warren on the other side. We'll whip around the AL Central, Major League Baseball in general, and we'll get you set up for this Jays Twins series that begins tonight at 8:10 with Kevin Gausman taking on Pablo Lopez. Let's exercise some demons in a low leverage way. Jays Talk Plus continues on Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A little Pavement there playing us back. Jays back in action tonight. Last night, more really impressive stuff from Bowden Francis, such that our next guest was tweeting about it. David Lorelei of Fangraphs joins us now. David, good morning. How we doing, man?
Hey, I am doing great. I'm not doing as great as Bowden Francis has been pitching, though.
No, absolutely. I don't think there is a level of great that we could be while working on a Friday morning that reaches Bowden Francis's level. Like, he's doing stuff that, like, oh, the last Blue Jay to do this is Roy Halladay or Dave Steeb. Oh, the last Major League Baseball pitcher to do this was Clayton Kershaw and then Johan Santana. Pretty remarkable. And it's happened over, like, a decent, like, we're talking 34 innings this month. It's not like it's a one-start blip. What have you made of the Bowden Francis experience here?
Well, man, I mean, I saw him last night, and I saw what he had done, you know, in his previous three starts. I think I forget the exact numbers, but it was like, wow. But I'd never actually watched him pitch, even on my laptop. Last night, I'm watching him, and what's really funny, Blake, is when I looked at his pitch breakdown after the game on Baseball Savant, I was surprised that he threw over 50% fastballs, because it seemed like there were more sliders than he actually threw. But, man, the fastball is like, it's not high velo, but it's guys don't hit it. And the ride he gets on it is good, but it's nothing, you know, it's not like 20 inches or anything, but it's just like, it's a wild fastball. And then, you know, the difference, with his splitter.
Yeah.
And he's on, man. He's good.
Yeah, it's pretty, you know, the splitter's new too, like in-season addition with the splitter. And like, obviously we know those high ride fastballs play well off a splitter if you tunnel them well and things like that. But it's been pretty remarkable how much the results have come, not just on the splitter, but the fastball results have gotten way better since he started throwing the splitter. Did you didn't get a chance to talk to him this series, did you?
No, you know, I didn't. And I'm remiss to not. I blame Hazel May because two days ago, I thought to myself, hey, I've got to grab, you know, Bowden Francis. And when I saw him come into the, the clubhouse, Hazel walked over and said, hey, can I get you outside? You know, so, yeah, I blame Hazel.
Well, we don't blame Hazel here. I'm sure that turned into really great content for us at Sportsnet. So sorry, David. Would have loved to hear about your chat with them, but we'll give the nod to Hazel here. Who did you get to chat with this week, if anyone on the Jays side, by the way?
Of some shorter things with, you know, various guys, but the longer thing I did was with Joey Laperfido. We just talked about his hitting approach and development as a hitter, so that will probably run at FanGraphs sometime in the next week or so. I was very impressed with Joey. He's from University of Duke University, whatever, and he sort of fits that profile. Just very well spoken, thoughtful guy, and he can hit a little bit. Although I will say, Blake, I was chatting in the back of the press box with a scout who was there. And we were talking a lot of Jays. He's not a huge Laperfido fan, which I thought was interesting. He doesn't love the swing to handle, you know, high velo up in the zone, yet. So, you know, we'll have to see how that goes over time.
Yeah, we'll have to see how that develops. And, you know, one of the things we've heard internally here is that they like, you know, the level of thought he puts into the craft and maybe the potential that suggests for improving. But yeah, there are only so many things you can do if your swing has a limitation like that. But we'll see. It's looked better of late. Last night's collision with the monster aside, I want to go back to the Bowden Francis topic, David. And I mean, this isn't necessarily specific to Bowden, but him introducing a splitter and seeing better results from it is not a unique to Bowden Francis story. It's kind of the story of pitch mix over the last 2-3 years in baseball. I know you chatted with Bryce Miller about this just a couple weeks ago. What have you made of sort of, you know, splitter revolution is probably a little too far given it's still a pretty low percentage pitch, but we're seeing a lot more guys at least try to throw it sometimes now.
No, we certainly do. I think one thing that's happening, Blake, is we're getting away from the, oh, splitters are bad on the arm, which is out there for a long time, and it's never been proven that it actually is. John Schneider the other day was actually talking about the split and saying that he sees more pitchers throwing them going forward as well. I mean, hey, it's a great pitch. It plays off well, as you said, off of a four-seam with good ride. So I think we have sort of segued away from the combo of four-seamers up and curveballs down. You know, we are now seeing fewer curveballs and more splitters.
So when it comes to Bowden Francis, you know, again, small-ish sample here, but given what the numbers say, given what you saw last night, if we were to say, hey, he's in the Blue Jays rotation as the number four, number five guy to start next year, how comfortable do you think the Jays should be with that?
Well, I mean, man, if he's throwing like he has recently, and I mean, he's not this good. I mean, he's not, you know, right-handed Clayton Kershaw. I mean, right now he looks like just a fantastic pitcher, you know, so we'll tell. You know, I mean, we'll see. You know, will he maybe become, you know, as good as Kevin Gausman? I mean, I don't know. I learned a long time ago, Blake, to not get overly excited when pitchers have a good streak and vice versa. Guys sometimes get called up and they get their hat handed to them in 3 or 4 games. And a lot of fans think, he can't do it. He'll never do it. You know, and a year later, he's, you know, your number two starter.
Yeah. Bowden Francis was DFA 2 years ago. It's not, and I had to go down to Puerto Rican winter ball to find some more velocity in the curveball and things like that. Things change quickly. I have 2 hours of radio to fill every day, so I'm a little more willing to, extrapolate from small samples. I wanted to pivot off of Jay's topics to ask you about another pitcher who I'm buying on after a pretty good stretch of play here. And you spoke to Spencer Arrighetti a couple weeks ago, a Houston Astros pitcher, rookie at 24. And I remember reading a great interview you had with him in spring training and then this interview with him more recently. I'm curious what you thought of where he was in spring training and where he is now from a mentality standpoint, and as like, hey, this is a young pitcher who understands like the analytics, the pitch metrics and things like that, but there's a learning curve with that too in terms of how do you actually use that, how do you actually implement that when you're on the mound.
Exactly. And you know, if you read the articles, Blake, you know this already, but I mean, and jumping back half a step, Arrighetti almost threw a no-hitter two days ago. You know, he went into the eighth inning and he gave up a ground ball into the 5-6 hole. that the third baseman arguably should have snagged. But anyway, yes, Eric Geddy, when I talked to him in spring training, at which point I knew not a whole lot about him, he like went full on nerd with me, throwing out, you know, terms like vertical approach angle and, you know, all seam shifted wake, really unprompted. And I walked away thinking, man, it's like talking to, you know, Garrett Cole. And so when I approached him at Fenway Park, you know, fairly recently, I said, hey, man, do you have time to talk? And, you know, we can maybe talk if anything at all has changed since spring. And he said, sure, let's sit down. And I said, what's different? The next words that came out of my mouth were like 4 or 5 minutes later. and he is so thoughtful about pitching, but the crux of what he was saying, as you read, was he was so big into pitch metrics and chasing shapes and chasing velo that once he got to the big leagues, he realized, hey, he can't do that anymore. He can't be that guy. He has to use the information and talent that he has and be a quote-unquote pitcher about it. He actually referred to himself as needing to be more of a pitcher and less of a thrower, at which point I said, dude, you know analytics like the back of your head. How could you possibly have been a thrower? And he said he really was, because he was trying to make pitches do certain things instead of trying to tunnel them well and use scouting reports and get guys out, which was for a young pitcher, and I'm sure he talked to some really smart people in the org, some veteran pitchers, you know, about that, who helped mold him. But right now he is Bowden Francis quality, except over maybe a little longer stretch than Bowden, correct? It's not Bowden.
Yes.
Yeah. He has been as good as Bowden Francis this season.
Yeah. It's an interesting contrast, you know, more walks, but way more strikeouts. And he's done it over maybe 40, 45 more innings. I find this stuff fascinating. Like I had a good chat with Chris Bassett earlier in the season that it was just kind of an aside. And we were talking about analytics in general, and I'm paraphrasing here, but his general take on it was like, yeah, it can help me, you know, improve my pitches, prep for an opponent or whatever. But once I get on the mound, like that stuff can't be front of, like you can't let that dictate how you're pitching. And I do wonder if we're slow, like with the vocabulary and the understanding so many young pitchers have with this kind of stuff now, if we're going to reach a point where, to oversimplify, hey, that's the stuff that drives your off-season work and, you know, the work you're doing on pitch shape and velocity and things like that, and maybe even in the minor leagues, but the hurdle in the majors is going to be that pitch ability. How do you throw it? Where do you throw it? Like Bowden Francis' splitter, it hasn't been crazy effective because it has insane break. It has good break, but he locates it really, really well. And it sounded like in your chat with Spencer Urgetti, that's a lot of what he was saying as well, was like, okay, well, it's not enough to just throw this down the heart and it's got good shape. I got to throw it in this guy's cold zones and things like that. Do you think that's kind of a fair general, like oversimplification to put it, that is like, hey, this is the analytics side for pitchers is going to, you know, take you up until pregame, and then you're going to have to learn to pitch after that?
Well, I think that's the case. I don't even think it's up to pregame. It's up to maybe the start of the season. Mm-hmm. You know, you developed all of your stuff. You've looked at a lot of tech, and you know how your stuff plays, and you don't really need to chase from there. You mentioned Chris Bassett. When I talked to Bassett earlier this summer, he talked really a lot about, because he has all of these pitches, right? You know, it's he and Seth Lugo are the, you know, I have 7 or 8 or 9 pitches. And he talked a lot about it really being more just natural feel than the actual analytics that he saw on his pitches. He knows where he can naturally make the ball break in a certain direction fairly well, and he'll play around with it. And it sounded like he paid only cursory attention, you know, to the actual data while he was doing it, which was interesting.
Yeah, he's a fascinating guy. You mentioned Seth Lugo as well. I this is a natural pivot point, I guess, to another guy I wanted to ask you about. Tyler Holton, who is probably not a household name, but he's put together two really, really good high-volume relief pitching seasons for the Tigers now. Like, sub-3 ERA, he's going to push close to 100 innings as a multi-inning relief guy this year. And he throws 6 pitches. And it does seem like we've had, like, an uptick in this Chris Bassett kitchen sink type of guy over the last couple of years, but it's so fascinating to see it in a reliever profile. My head goes to, well, why don't you start if you throw six different pitches? How was your chat with Tyler Holton? And, you know, what do you make of that idea? A six pitch reliever who can, you know, do so many different things in a role we don't usually see that in.
Well, I did broach the, hey, why aren't you a starter thing at the end of our conversation that we had just about a week and a half ago. I actually talked to him at Wrigley Field when the Tigers were there. Love making Chicago trips, Blake. I love that city.
Yeah.
But no, Holton, it is odd. You know, you mentioned sub-3 ERA. Since the beginning of last season, he has the lowest earned run average of any pitcher in baseball who's thrown more than 150 innings. I think he's in the low 160s. And that's over like maybe 110, 112 appearances. And it's like, wow, you keep waiting for a guy who doesn't have, quote unquote, you know, great stuff to suddenly slide backwards a little bit. And Holton, you know, hasn't done it because he knows how to pitch. And certainly A.J. Hinch and Chris Fetter and the whole Tiger staff know how to optimize him, get him in the right situation so he can do that. But again, piggybacking on that, for him, situations are, you know, he's been an opener a few times. You know, he'll come in to face lefties in the seventh inning. He'll pitch the eighth inning. He'll get a save now and again. So he is like a Swiss Army knife who is arguably the most underrated pitcher in baseball.
Yeah, it's pretty and it underrated. I think, you know, hey, you're a reliever on the Tigers. It makes sense. And then, you know, yeah, I don't know. It's it's interesting to have this kind of like very unique pitcher. Like, I know there are a couple guys out there who do the long relief thing. You know, Drew Smyly's got, if you're a fantasy player in a holds league, you're very familiar with the season Drew Smyly's having with starting pitcher eligibility. It's interesting to see. And it's just interesting to see the trend in guys. More guys like this who throw a bunch of different stuff. Okay, before I let you go here, Garrett Crochet told you something similar. He already throws four pitches, but he wants to add a third. So he's, you know, obviously got the sweeper and the changeup, and then he throws a four-seam fastball and a cutter, and now he's looking to add a sinker as well. What does that tell you when you talk to a guy whose stuff is at that high of the high end, and even a guy like that is talking about, yeah, what about a fifth pitch? What about a third fastball?
Right. Well, you know, talking to Crochet, which I also did on my Chicago trip, you know, he is primarily the four seam and the cutter, which is for him, it's a lethal combination. He talked to me more about, you know, the sinker being a possibility that he's throwing a lot on the side, trying to see if he can mix it in. But he said he's more interested in upping the use of his slider, his sweeper slider, and, you know, and the changeup. So he's a little bit more varied. So he doesn't have to just go attack with, you know, two pitches. And once next year, you know, assuming health, they'll be ramping up his innings total, which as a starter, that's valuable because he, of course, is a converted reliever and they've been very careful with his innings. We're seeing a lot of, you know, four inning starts really. Frankly, he had the four-pitch start right before the rainout last week, which is a crazy thing about the new rules is that actually counted as a start,
yeah.
Even though he faced one batter who didn't get on and he didn't retire him. So that's baseball, man.
Yeah, that's we've talked about this a lot because obviously the Jays and Red Sox had that makeup suspended game today, and now, you know, Will Wagner's first career hit is when he wasn't even in the majors and things like that. I think I understand why that rule exists. I think if no out is retired in the game, we could just not call that a suspended game. That's maybe one too far for me, David, I think.
No, I think it is. And, you know, you mentioned Tigers and with suspended games. Al Kaline, of course, ended up with 399 home runs. And he hit, I know, at least one in a game that went like four innings, got rained out, and that got taken off of his off the stat sheet. You know, which is... You know, that's kind of dumb, Blake. A Hall of Famer hit a home run to a round number, and it was, doesn't count.
You know this is the plot of the Bernie Mac movie Mr. 3000, right?
No, I have never seen that.
So it is the reverse where he retires immediately after getting to 3,000 hits. He's like, you can't keep me out of the Hall of Fame. I have 3,000 hits. And then when they're recounting the numbers, they realize a suspended game actually got double counted. So he doesn't have 3,000 hits anymore. And then he has to like come back at like 45. He's basically, he does the hitter version of Rich Hill. He's like, I got to come back at 45. I got to get my three more hits to get the 3,000. So it's the reverse Al Kaline line, that movie.
That is a great plot. Yeah. Do we have time to slide in one last quick thing, Blake?
Yeah, of course. Especially if it's related to Bernie Mac and Mr. 3,000 and Al Kaline.
No, but it is related to the Tigers. I saw there was a great sad article in the Detroit Free Press yesterday by Jeff Seidel, is that I think a lot of your listeners, at least of a certain age, will remember Chet Lemon, who played for the White Sox and then was a Tigers center fielder throughout the 80s. He would have been there in the 87 season when the Jays fans want to forget, of course. But Chet Lemon will be in Detroit. I believe it's tomorrow, maybe Sunday. They're going to celebrate the 1984 Tigers. And he will be in a wheelchair because he has had, I believe the number is 13 strokes.
Yeah.
And he can no longer walk or talk. But he recognizes everybody. And he, I mean, a sad story. But a borderline Hall of Fame player will get to, people will cheer him, you know, in what's probably late in his life at a ballpark. And I think that's a wonderful thing to think about.
Yeah, it's a really great story. And yeah, that's happening Saturday at the Tigers game. So make sure you fire up your MLB TV, or I don't know if we have the game or anything like that, but that'll certainly be a moment worth watching. Social media, if nothing else. David, thanks for that note, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks, Blake. Always happy to come on.
David Lorela of Fangraphs, a lot of great interviews with hitters and pitchers about the science behind their craft, just what goes into it in general. He really gets guys to open up about their process. And yeah, some of it skews analytics. You talked to Spencer Arrighetti about his pitch metrics and stuff like that, but a lot of it is just, hey, talking hitting, hey, talking pitching, and how a guy like Arrighetti at 24 or Bowden Francis at 28 learns how to pitch, in addition to, hey, I can spin the ball a bunch or have a big fastball or whatever. Let's take a break. Let's take a look at the AL Central and set up this Jays Twin Series. We'll talk to Anthony Castrovince and Brandon Warren on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Long weekend ahead, and my voice has held up through most of the show, upsetting the odds makers. So we got one segment left here. Let's tag in Anthony Castrovince of MLB.com and author of A Fan's Guide to Baseball Analytics. Anthony, good morning. Thank you for doing this. How are we doing?
No problem, Blake. Thanks for having me, man.
Got to ask you, this is, normally I'd be more prepared than this, but you dropped an article while I was on air, so I have not gotten to read your piece about Iron Mike Marshall yet. However, I do have a soft spot for Mike Marshall because I was an Expos fan before they moved away, and he came second in Cy Young voting for the Expos in the 70s, and then also led the league in games played like five or six times or something like that. What is your piece about Mike Marshall about? Can you give me the quick take on it?
Well, just giving a nod, first of all, to this is the 50th anniversary of his actual Cy Young season with the Dodgers right after your Expos traded him. And it's even more bonkers now to look at those numbers than it was 50 years ago, where he pitched 106 games. He finished 83 games. That's obviously not happening today. So a nod of appreciation to that. And just to look at his legacy, you know, a guy who obviously he was eccentric. He was brusque, and, you know, the league did turn its back on him and his methods, but some of his methods ended up being adopted anyway. He was very much ahead of his time.
So can you give me an example or two of those? I mean, look, if you're going to throw 106 games in a season, we should, and hold up and do it multiple years, we should be able to learn something from you.
Well, he pursued his PhD while playing at Michigan State, and at one time, you know, he wasn't getting the results he wanted or the health he wanted, and an agriculture teacher convinced him to take a high-speed camera from the agriculture department and to look at his motion frame by frame. And he did that, and he saw things in his delivery that he had to change. And, you know, that was in the 1960s. And you go to spring training today, what do you see everywhere? High-speed cameras. You know, it's become commonplace for every pitcher on every team. So he was about, you know, about 60 years ahead of time.
Yeah, it's pretty fun, and I've already got one response in saying, don't ask who the Expos traded him away for. It was for Willie Davis, who they only got 1 year out of at the tail end of his career. Okay, Anthony, looking forward to reading that piece. Let's pivot off of that to the stuff I'm actually prepared for, which is to talk to you about an AL Central race that not that long ago seemed like it was probably going to be the Guardians safely in first, and then the Twins and maybe the Royals competing for a wild card spot. And now suddenly we've got the Royals really pushing the Guardians for that top spot. We did find out earlier in the show, Vinny Pascantino is going to be out 6 to 8 weeks with a broken thumb. But generally, what have you made of this Royals push? And I mean, I guess also the less than stellar play of the Guardians to kind of keep them at arm's length.
Well, just in general, I mean, these standings look more correct to me, because even when the Guardians were up 9 games, I mean, we're all looking at each other here in Cleveland going, how is this possible? How is this team, you know, vying for the best record of the majors and blowing away the competition AL Central? You know, really the number one way they did that was just putting the pedal to the metal when it comes to the bullpen. You know, they have not had a great rotation this year. They've dealt with injuries. They've dealt with ineffectiveness from certain guys. And it's caused them to really lean heavily on what's been the best bullpen in baseball, particularly three rookies back there, who are all, you know, like 60 plus appearances at this point. So that is starting, I think, to catch up with them a bit. You know, it has caught up with them a bit in recent weeks, and the offense went cold. It was obviously running very hot in the first half. So, you know, that's what's happened with Cleveland, essentially. With the Royals, you know, they've created a great energy around that club. You know, it started with just trying to go for it in the offseason. They weren't, you know, these weren't like top of the market expenditures, but they were expenditures. They did try to get better. You sign a guy like Michael Wacha, who's been, you know, you look up and he's been a very successful pitcher in the league for a long time in terms of wins and losses. And, you know, he brought some pedigree to that rotation, and Seth Lugo has been an incredible signing for them. So you start there and then just they gain confidence. You know, they get some early wins and gain confidence and kind of snowballs. They had a great trade deadline. Lucas Urseg, you know, it was a huge boost for their bullpen. But you mentioned the Pasquantino injury. You know, they've had two tough losses here in a row, and then to lose him from the lineup for the next, whatever it is, 6 to 8 weeks. That's a huge blow, no doubt about it. But that is a confident club.
Yeah, so we'll see how they, you know, this is obviously one of the tests of I was going to say young team. They're young on the position player side for the most. I guess their star is young, is what I'm trying to say. Bobby Witt Jr. Is young. They've surrounded him with vet help. We'll see how they withstand that. Either way, it is on pace to be, if not the greatest single season turnaround in league history, very, very close, going from 106 losses last year to almost certainly a playoff spot here. Are you surprised, given where our expectations were at the start of the year for each of these teams individually, that we've got about a 75% chance here of three AL Central teams making the postseason?
Yeah, that's crazy. That, you know, I did think the AL Central would be better this year. I thought the Tigers would also be in that mix of just vying in contention. You know, I could see a four-team race breaking out there, but for where it is relative to the rest of the league, you know, that's the shocker. A lot of that comes down to just the Mariners falling on their face over the course of the season. And they could still get back in that mix, but, and the Red Sox as well are kind of hanging around, but, you know, it's stunning. It's just stunning that you're right. There's a better chance than not of three AL Central teams. And that just goes to show the fluky nature of baseball, because there was a time where maybe that would have been less shocking just because, you know, the heavy weighted within the division. And, you know, you have a 104 loss team within that division. So, you know, that certainly plays some role in this, but not the pointed role that it used to be, you know, because of the more balanced schedule.
Yeah, I guess the biggest impact of the White Sox has just been the Guardians' inability to beat them. Like, the Guardians are 5-5 against the White Sox. What the heck happened there?
Well, the Guardians, they're 5-5 against maybe the worst team, you know, in the live ball era. And they're 0-8 in doubleheaders. And they're in first place, so figure that out.
Unbelievable. Here's a question. Did you ever, or do you play out of the park baseball? Probably not. You're an adult.
I'm an adult with three kids. Yeah. Maybe they'll start playing that stuff, and then then I can have some fun and play that stuff.
Okay. So I don't have kids, and even though I'm an adult, I'm not really an adult. Do you think I could replicate a 230 win percentage team in that game with the caveat that, like, they have to be, like, I can't, like, fill a roster with single A guys. Like, they've got to be fringe. Do you think it's possible to replicate?
I'm still not sure how it's possible in real life. And, you know, that's with some pleasant surprise. You know, Eric Fetty was a really pleasant surprise for them. They turned into a nice trade chip for them. Garrett Crochet has been one of the best pitchers in baseball. You know, so it's not like they're totally absent some good stories within that context, but by gosh, what a dog.
Yeah, not great. Okay, let's pivot to the NL where the races are interesting as well. The Mets still hanging around three games back of the Braves. It really does feel like league-wide everyone's been like, well, the Mets vibes are way better, but the Braves, you know, pragmatically, you know, maybe the better choice despite their injuries there. What do you make of that race and how that is shaping up here for September?
Well, you just see the championship pedigree of the Braves proving true here in recent weeks, because it did start to feel like their season was going off the rails. You know, there's only so much you can overcome from an injury perspective. They've just been hit left and right, started with Ronald Acuna Jr. and Spencer Strider, and then continuing on with Ozzie Albies, et cetera. So, you know, the fact that they're still somewhat in the NL East race. I mean, a tough loss last night doesn't help that much. They're six games back of the Phillies, but that's a team that just knows how to win and persevere. Matt Olson's really heated up of late, so that's big for them. But, you know, don't put it past the Mets to still make it around the wild card. They've had several good series in a row here, stringing those together. Just took down the D-backs at home, which we've seen is extremely difficult to do. They won two of three there. So, you know, so much of their problems extend to the bullpen and just having the bullpen right. If Edwin Diaz, you know, doesn't blow two games this week, you know, the math is a lot different for them. So they obviously need to get him straightened out, and that was big for him to get the 1-2-3 save last night.
You mentioned the Diamondbacks there. You tweeted earlier in the week that even though you're a part of the voting panel at MLB.com's Power Rankings, you thought they were a little low ranked at number eight. What do you like about that team? Like, quietly, I don't know, and maybe Ketel Marte is like the perfect star for them because it feels like he's very under the radar, even in, you know, I guess when Shohei's on pace for 50-50, it's easy to be under the radar in an MVP race. But this is also like the number one offense in baseball by run scoring, which I think would probably surprise some people.
Yeah, I'm very much in the tank for that club and have been. You know, last year I thought they were going to be really frisky, and it turned out they vastly exceeded my expectations by going to World Series. And then this year I felt even better about them because they shored up their rotation. They were very aggressive in the winter. Shorter rotation added some power. It didn't prove true in the first couple months of the season because they were so banged up. They could not get a healthy turn in the rotation. But lo and behold, they get a little healthier there, and things start to look the way they envisioned. And, yeah, the power rankings are always difficult. You're always kind of balancing what the standings are telling you, you know, ranking the teams from, you know, 1 to 30 in terms of winning percentage versus – you know, what your gut tells you or what the future might hold or how much do you weight the recent past. And, you know, the Diamondbacks have been the best team in baseball going back to the beginning of June. So that doesn't mean they're number one in the power rankings. But, you know, when I called up on Monday and they're number eight still, I'm like, come on, what do we got to do here? I tried to goose it for what little my vote counts amongst our large voting body. I tried to goose it as much as I could for the D-backs. I put them at number two. I put them Dodgers one. And D-backs too this week, just because I felt like they deserved it. They've just been playing lights out for months now. But I get it. Like, it's hard because you look at the standings and they're in second place and they're four games back going into this big weekend against the Dodgers. So there is a balance there, but man, that team has been running hot.
Yeah, it's I don't know. This just paints the picture of Will is like power mad, and he's not listening to your votes in the power rankings. That's the only conclusion I can draw from this, Anthony.
No, it's a large group, so I won't pin it on Will, but yeah, maybe he could have finagled it in the last minute. He can control the math ultimately and get in there and rig it if he wants, but I think he's on the up and up.
All right, last one for you before I let you go here. Rich Hill returned to Major League Baseball last night. I know you had tweeted about this. I think everyone over a certain age who covers baseball has tweeted about it. Man, how wild is that for you to see a guy making a comeback here at 44?
Yeah, he had said this was his plan going into the year, that he was going to go watch his son play Little League for the last time. You know, his son was in the last year of Little League, and then and then sign with the team for the second half. And you always knew that the Red Sox were probably the most likely scenario for a couple of reasons. One is just the connection to Rich Hill, and two is probably the need, you know, and lo and behold, they had the need. So great to see him, you know, get out there last night. And that's now officially 2024 goes down as his 20th major league season. He's the only active player to appear in 20 seasons. And that's a guy who had to reinvent himself multiple times along the way and persevere, and great pro, and, you know, great clubhouse guy, all those great qualities, and can still get out. So that's great to see.
Yeah, he got four big outs yesterday. Didn't result in a win for the Red Sox, but pretty good outing for him. First time back. Yeah, man, Rich Hill. Anthony Kastrovitz, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, man. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Anthony Kastrovitz of MLB.com and author of A Fan's Guide to Baseball Analytics. So that is a good chunk of the AL Central we took a look at there, and a check-in on the NL playoff race. We're going to take – I intentionally left the Minnesota Twins out of that conversation because we're going to talk to Brandon Warren here in a second of Access Twins and Locked On Twins about that Twins team. It is a Twins team that has not played particularly well. When the Jays took 3 of 5 against the Red Sox – and yes, only 4 of those were the official series, but they count in the standings right now. You would have thought the Twins would have been able to make up some ground, but they've dropped 4 in a row to Atlanta and St. Louis, and they've dropped 9 of 11. They desperately need to turn things around against this Blue Jays team because, yes, they are in a wild card spot, but they've missed an opportunity to maybe catch ground on the Guardians. They're 3.5 back in that division race, and they're only 3.5 up on Boston. Fangraphs still gives them 85% playoff odds, in part because they have a really strong run differential and things like that. But this is a team that has Carlos Correa, Byron Buxton, Alex Kirilov all on the IL on the hitter side. Joe Ryan, Chris Paddock, Anthony DeSclafani done for the year on the pitching side. They just claimed Michael Tonkin from the Yankees and DFA'd old friend Trevor Richards. A lot going on there for a team that has looked like a fairly safe playoff bet for a little bit here. Let's get the pulse of the Twins with Brandon Warren of Access Twins, of Locked On Twins. Brandon, how we doing, buddy?
Hey, we're doing good. How you been?
Oh, man, what a good hair day you've got going on, man. You brought it today. All right. Yeah. Were you a Jays fan this week? They were up. I know the Twins didn't take care of their side of things, but how closely were you watching that 5-game set against the Red Sox, hoping the Jays can maybe put the Red Sox out of reach on your behalf?
You know, I'm always kind of watching everybody. But, yeah, no, I was definitely kind of pulling like, hey, Toronto, can you do something for me? I know you probably aren't in the business of doing that, but it was – you know, there's so many different things to watch with how many wild card teams there are now, where it's so hard to pick up ground when somebody has to win on any given night. So your head's kind of spinning trying to keep track of your division and the wild card and all that stuff. So I'm doing my best.
The Jays, did you feel a little bit like the Jays owed you one after the Trevor Richards experience?
Oh, man. You know, Trevor Richards got a raw deal coming in for Joe Ryan when he got hurt at Wrigley Field, but man alive, he did not do much else positive besides. So, yeah, no, that was greatly appreciated. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And obviously, you know, we are fond of Trevor Richards here. I'd assume he'll land somewhere. But, yeah, weird stint with the Minnesota Twins. So this is a Twins team that's been in a rough spot. I mentioned before you came on, they've dropped 9 of 11 here to kind of make this wild card race tighter than it should be, maybe even squander an opportunity to catch the Guardians here. What's gone into that? Because I start to look through and it's like, okay, Bailey Ober's struggled a little bit. You know, Max Kepler's slumping, but it's not like this is like a team-wide, everyone's been bad kind of thing. What's been going on the last couple of weeks?
The bullpen's been a lot more mortal. You know, Griffin Jacks has been tremendous all season long. He's a top 5, top 10 reliever in the AL and maybe even globally. But Juan Duran has been a lot less of the, like, incredible version of himself. He's still hitting 100 and then some with the fastball, but just a bit more hittable this year, fewer strikeouts. And, you know, Brock Stewart being down, he was a guy who was big for them down the stretch last year and in the playoffs. Caleb Thielbar has definitely taken a turn in the wrong direction. They've had a few guys come around. Cole Sands has looked a lot better, but just so far, the bullpen lately has been shaky. And then the offense just, you know, if you need 4, they'll give you 3. If you need 5, they'll give you 4. It's some of the more frustrating baseball you can watch. As a person who's watched baseball for a long time, you're just like, well, that's baseball. That's going to happen over long stretches or even medium to long stretches of the season. But when you're starting to run out of daylight to either, you know, make some hay in the division or at least keep the Red Sox at bay, the frustration leads to even more like tense, you know, nights on Twitter with all the other fans and that sort of thing. So it's crunch time, and it's time to see how they're going to respond. But like you said, without Carlos Correa, without Byron Buxton, without Alex Kirilloff, you know, last I looked, every player the Twins have as a hitter on the IL was drafted top 15 in the MLB draft. Brooks Lee is the other, if you're wondering. So they've had some real talent that they're missing right now, and they're just not quite piecing it together with, you know, what's a pretty good group of depth besides. It's just not good enough to keep them afloat against, you know, a healthy Kansas City team who now is less healthy with the Pasquantino news.
Yeah, and it's, you know, this is a Blue Jays team that has played a little bit better of late, but certainly a team the Twins offense could. I mean, they're going to see Kevin Gausman tonight. It seemed like for a while, like the Twins have something on him. On the positive side, what has clicked for Matt Wallner this year? Like, we're talking about over the last month, like almost the Aaron Judge level weighted runs created plus. He's up at like 183 run, weighted runs created plus on the season, an OPS over 1,000. And I know it's only been 50 games because he hasn't been up here the entire time. But what has what's clicked? What's gone right for Matt Wallner here?
Well, I don't want to twist the knife, but among pitchers, active pitchers with at least 50 innings pitched, Gausman's ERA against the Twins is the highest. So you're on to something there.
Yeah.
As far as Wallner, you know, he started off, he made the team on spring training, started off just dreadfully. Like, he had a couple homers and got hit by a couple pitches, but that was it. And so they sent him to St. Paul, and the results there were not good to start. And then he just kind of clicked, something caught fire. Maybe a month before they called him up, because I believe he won International Player of the Month, International League Player of the Month for June. And then from that point on, he's been just crushing everything in sight. He is third in OPS among AL hitters, MLB hitters since July 1st. And it's an incredible list. It's Aaron Judge, it's Bobby Witt Jr., you know, and it's Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who you're obviously very familiar with crushing the baseball. I think Vlad's third and Wallner's fourth. So with Wallner, I mean, I've been looking at StatCast or Baseball Savant, and his swing is as fast, his bat speed is as fast as anybody's in baseball, and he's been connecting. You know, they've been shielding him against some of the tougher lefties. That may not work if Manuel Margot can't catch the baseball. They may have to just let Wallner kind of ride. But for now, he's been crushing righties, which is basically what he was meant to do, and working good counts, that sort of thing. If he doesn't strike out as much as he has in the past, he becomes an imminently more dangerous hitter. And I know I'm not exactly saying anything controversial there, but after watching Joey Gallo play for the Twins last year, this is definitely a breath of fresh air.
And also a guy who, while not the most fleet of foot outfielder, has an absolute cannon out there. So yeah, kind of a stat cast king there if he can pull it all together.
If he homers, watch for this too. He does a moose celebration that, as much as you won't enjoy him homering, the celebration is pretty funny.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate a moose. I got a couple of them on me there. That's a very Canadian thing of him to do, by the way, which leads me to pivot to Edouard Julien is getting some playing time a little more regularly of late because of the injuries there. He's been up and down this year. What have you seen from Edouard Julien of late?
Well, so he started off really well and then just completely fell off to where it was almost like his controller batteries were dying and he was just taking called third pitches left and right. And he came back one time when he wasn't quite ready yet and he was kind of still doing that. But now that since he's been back, he's had more defensive issues. You know, he had a throw on a play at the plate where they were playing in that just it was nowhere near where it needed to be, and the runner scored anyway. So the defense has been a bit of a step back, but offensively he's kind of doing his thing. He's still striking out, but you know, he's driving the ball into the gaps a bit more, and you know, he's not back up to the top of the batting order like he had been when things were going well to start the year. Willie Castro's kind of been a mainstay up there. But so far, he's been more of a, you know, just a line mover at the bottom of the order. You know, base hits here and there. I don't think he's hit a ton of extra base hits, you know, not driving the ball out of the ballpark yet. But I feel like whatever it was that was causing him to, it almost felt like he was quiet quitting. You know, like he's just at the plate and taking strikes, 1, 2, 3. And whatever that was seems to be trending in his rear view mirror. Now it's just time to kind of nail it down at second base because Brooks Lee is close. I mean, I saw him play in St. Paul on Sunday on his rehab. And, you know, the plan is for either him to play short and Royce to play second or Willie to play second. There's a lot of options here, but some of those options are that Edouard Julien doesn't get to play much anymore. So he's got to tighten it up pretty quickly here. But when things are going well for him, he's one of their best players.
All right, looking at the probables for this series, we're going to see Pablo Lopez tonight. He has really turned around what was an uncharacteristically shaky start. They get 2.39 ERA over his last eight. Anything materially changed with what Lopez is doing there, or this just obviously he was going to figure it out? He's Pablo Lopez.
I think his sweeper has been better, and he also, one thing to be aware of is when he gets ambushed hard. He's fifth in the AL in OPS allowed on first pitches among qualifiers. And so he's going to be like 1,100 OPS when he gives up a first pitch contact. And, you know, on the opposite side, like Joe Ryan, Yusei Kikuchi, who you guys had for a while, and then Jose Berríos has been tremendous at that. Well, on the opposite side of things, it has been our guy Pablo here. And so if things kind of snowball for him, you know, he'll give up a homer like once every start, almost without fail. And then it's, how does he respond? You know, and a lot of times he responds pretty well for a bad season, still having a low fours ERA. You know, that goes to show that, you know, the expectation that a guy like that sets for you when a better than league average ERA by a fairly sizable amount is still a bad season. But the way things have turned around lately too, I think he's just pitched with a little more confidence. He's looked a little more Pablo-esque. And being at home has been an issue too. He struggled at home a bit this year. So this will be a good chance for him to kind of keep pushing away from that narrative and hopefully lining up to pitch in October again.
Yeah. It's I don't want to see that again as a Blue Jays guy, but yeah. Right. Okay. Last one for you before I let you go here. Zebby Matthews will pitch Saturday, three starts under his belt. Now he has over four different levels this year, only walked nine guys in 112 innings. Obviously, that's the headline item with him, but what have you liked of his first couple starts here?
He's just a competitor. I mean, you don't blitz through the minor leagues without having just an intense work ethic and desire to be the best version of yourself. And, you know, not walking anybody in and of itself is not always the badge of courage that we think it is, because there's been plenty of guys who didn't walk anybody who got hit hard. But he manages through, I guess you could call it the pitching lab, Pete Mackey and friends. He throws it hard enough. He mixes things up enough. You know, he cuts the ball and all that good stuff, where his location plus his stuff has turned him into, you know, I think a number three, number four starter. And they've been doing that with a lot of guys. If you look at their top 30 on MLB Pipeline, it's CJ Culpepper, it's, you know, Andrew Morris, a bunch of other guys that you may not have heard of yet, but they keep churning out fourth, fifth, seventh round picks that they turn into capable big league pitchers. Look no further than Bailey Ober, who was nowhere near a top draft pick. So that's the fun thing, is Zebby is another success in a pitching pipeline that is finally coming to fruition.
Yeah, how do you do that? I would like to borrow some of that. The Jays do a good job, like bench second base left fielders. We got you covered, yeah. But
ask Cleveland, because that's where the Twins stole it from.
Yeah, the AL Center. Both of those teams, by the way, with like top five farm systems in baseball as well. Yes. So the AL yes. Central is heading in the right direction here with three playoff teams potentially. We'll see. How are you feeling about the playoff race generally? Before we only got like a minute left here, but you confident they're going to be able to hold on to a spot here?
Yeah, I just feel like there's not that much urgency from everybody else who's not in there, and not because they're not urgent, but just they're not playing that well. So as fans are pretty down about how the Twins have played lately, realistically, they're still in a good spot. Like you said, Fangraphs says 85%, and I think I saw 82% somewhere else. So, I mean, it's still a pretty good shot. So once you get in and figure it out the rest of the way.
Yeah, well, hope the Blue Jays don't do you any favors this weekend, but hope you have a good time with the games. Brandon, thanks for doing this, buddy.
Be good.
Brandon Warren of Access Twins, of Locked On Twins. Again, it's Pablo Lopez against Kevin Gausman tonight. Lopez with a fascinating season. 4.26 ERA, which is a little on the high end for Pablo Lopez versus what we've come to expect, but a 2.39 over his last eight. What's really interesting is that his fastball by run value has graded out as the number one pitch in all of baseball this year. Now, normally we think of, okay, well, he's a fastball sweeper changeup guy, throws a sinker too. You know, he throws more righty to righty changeups because the changeup is so good. Those pitches have not been super effective for him this year until recently. The fastball, though, again, the number one rated pitch in baseball by run value. The Jays weirdly haven't seen Pablo Lopez a lot in regular season sample. Only 38 plate appearances, and six of those are Kevin Gausman. Of the guys who could actually play tonight, they're 3 for 26 against Pablo Lopez. So not a great sample there. You heard Brandon mention it. Kevin Gausman has one of the worst ERAs of any active pitcher against this Twins team. They got to him for six earned runs in each of his last two starts against him. He had a bad one in 2022 as well. Overall, it's 127 plate appearances for the active Twins against Kevin Gausman, and they're hitting just shy of 300 and slugging just shy of 500. So yeah, could be a tough one. Royce Lewis, Edward Julian, Willie Castro, Carlos Santana, Trevor Larnach, all with pretty good career numbers against Gausman. We'll see. He's coming off a 10 strikeout start against the Angels. We'll see if he can build on that one. That wraps us up for the week. We made it. Thank you to Caitlin McGrath, Ryan Hawkinsmith, David Lorla, Anthony Kastrovince, and Brandon Warren for joining us today. Thank you to Amit Mann, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Thank you to Kevin Barker for putting together the new chairs that we have in this studio. Thank you to all you guys for listening. Hope you have a wonderful long weekend. We will talk to you Tuesday at 10 a.m. Have a great one, guys.